Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of debate, dialogue, healthcare and science in the news, education, and answers to your questions via email or on the phone. But before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily the station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. A little bit of an update on the not intended for a substitute for a professional consultation. This is true also, I should think, of things you read on the internet. And it's important to realize that when young medical students with their heads crammed full of information first start trying to take care of patients, there's a tendency to over-diagnose. There's a tendency to try and take symptoms and with those symptoms decide what the diagnosis is. Nausea, rash, and headache? Oh, well, that's encephalitis. Well, it's also a rash and a headache, and it may not be a serious disease. You can't diagnose from symptoms without a great deal of clinical experience, and you can't get at that on the internet. So just a little caveat about to those people who imagine that they can be a doctor based on reading. It is an apprenticeship profession, and you need a lot of oversight and a lot of practice to get anywhere near being a decent diagnostician. That being said, little editorial statements there. Let's talk about something rather surprising. We've heard about the use of marijuana, medical marijuana, for nausea, vomiting, chemotherapy, weight gain, and HIV. There's good data for all of that. There's even better data for chronic pain. And certainly there are types of seizures that respond to CBD, which is cannabidiol, by the way. And cannabidiol also works for bones. Researchers at the University of Tel Aviv have been researching bone growth and using a rat model. Bone cells actually have CBD receptors on them, and CBD substantially speeds up bone fracture healing. It improves and increases the amount of cartilage. It stimulates bone formation, inhibits bone loss. So CBD may actually prove to be a decent way to combat osteoporosis and osteopenia in aging humans. We haven't done that research yet, but we have research in rats that suggests that very thing. CBD alone, out with all of the other components of marijuana like THC removed, still makes bones stronger during healing, enhances the maturation of the collagenous matrix, and provides the basis for new mineralization of bone tissue. So, very interesting information, and something like news you can use. More news you can use is this little article about Coca-Cola. And Coca-Cola, as well as all cola drinks, contain caramel coloring. Well, it turns out, my friends, that in the process of manufacturing caramel coloring, a compound called 4-methylimidazole is created. And 4-methylimidazole is a carcinogen. The acceptable levels of this are 29 micrograms per day. More than that, and you see excess cancer in cases. In certain parts of the country, you actually have to carry a warning label if you contain more than that, but not in most of the country. So researchers went around in California, and they purchased 110 samples of 12 different cola beverages, and they looked at how much was in there. There was one beverage called Malta Goya, which I've never seen on the shelves, but it had really outrageously high levels of this, 915 micrograms. And you'll remember I said 30 micrograms was considered the threshold level for experimentally observable increased cancer rates. The lowest one that came in was Coca-Cola, and that had 11 micrograms. So you could safely drink 3 Coca-Colas without crossing the cancer threshold. But if you were to consume even the lowest one here, Coca-Cola, you at more than 3 a day, you would actually be getting into a level where there would be a little bit of risk of increased risk of cancer. Maltagoya, Pepsi, Diet Pepsi, and Pepsi One had more exposures, higher enough levels, that the excess cancer rate was 1 per 10,000 exposed individual. And that is a substantial increased risk in epidemiological terms. I've always opposed the drinking of cola drinks because of their effect on bone structure. But here we go, another good reason to shy away from chemical soup. We're going to go to our first caller, and that is Linda in Monterey. Hello, Linda. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you, Dr. Dawn.
Good morning.
I please would like to speak about alternative non-toxic treatments for cancer.
Okay.
I'm reading a book, Outsmart Your Cancer, by Tanya Harter Pierce. And she did quite an investigation of many, many, many treatments. And she highly recommends Protocell, which is a product. It targets anaerobic cells by interfering with their cell respiration.
Mm-hmm.
It's currently sold as a general health enhancing product. And I wanted to know what you thought of that.
Can you tell me anything about the biology of that? Interferes with aerobic... With anaerobic, how? Does it say, or is this just an assertion?
Well, it says that all healthy cells are aerobic, so they are not harmed. And she does go into a whole lot of detail. Let me see if I can get that. Okay, so...
See, okay, while you're looking, I'll just say for the audience that anaerobic cells are acting like anaerobic bacteria, and they're primarily getting their energy from a process called glycolysis. Protocell, by the way, is an actual biological term. Somebody's come up with a product. And you said it was spelled C-E-L-L.
Well, capital P-R-O-T-O-C-E-L.
Mm-hmm.
Trademarked. And okay, so it says when a person takes Protocell regularly every day, the formula biochemically lowers the voltage of every cell in the body just a little bit. Actually, for those with technical backgrounds, the more accurate term is capsaicin rather than voltage, but most people understand the term voltage. This results in approximate voltage reduction of about 10 to 15%, and Protocell accomplishes this by interfering with the production of ADP, ATP in the cell, because anaerobic cells obtain their energy, like you said, from glycolysis. Instead of oxidation, they operate on a minimum energy level and sustain a lower voltage than normal cells.
Mm-hmm.
The slight reduction in voltage caused by Protocell shifts the cancer cells downward to a point below the minimum that cancer cells need to remain intact.
Okay, all right, you can stop now.
Okay.
And let me just say that that's a nice declarative statement.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely something that could be proven or disproven in a laboratory. So what you want to do with something like this is you then want to look for the actual research where someone in a laboratory does this and measures this and demonstrates this. This is...
They did it in vitro, the National Cancer Institute, but it...
Okay, so you want to look at the reference. You don't want to look at someone saying they did it somewhere. You want to actually track down the paper and see if there is a published article. Because, you see, you can make any declarative statement you want about something, and you can spin research, and you have to go... You really kind of have to go to the original source. So... As I look through this, you know, I was able in, I have my iPad here, so I did a quick search, and basically there is a great deal of people saying it's garbage, and a great deal of anecdotal, Protocell recovery stories. So essentially, there's infomercial action here, there's anecdotal people saying it helped them, and then there's people saying that it isn't biologically plausible. And so the problem with something like this is it's not a quick off-the-cuff thumbs up, thumbs down. You know, you really have to look at it. Maybe it has merit. Certainly a lot of the things I recommend for support of cancer therapy involve trying to exploit the fact that cancer cells switch to anaerobic metabolism, which means they need sugar. And if you can, if you lower sugar, if you eliminate starch, you go on a ketogenic diet, for example, there is at least some data. It's not it's not high quality data because it's hard to do large studies in these circumstances, and the ketogenic diet's really hard to follow. But there's enough data, I think, to make it promising. I don't know about data on this. Something like this, where people buy a product, what you really want is you want the company to, you know, round up 200 or 300 people and give half of them the product. That's still an underpowered study, but it would be enough to maybe see a deviation. And if you saw a deviation in that 300 people, the two groups separate in terms of survival or the rate, even the rate that their tumors grow, you know, that would be the kind of evidence I would like to see before recommending something. And we do have that kind of evidence on ketogenic diets, but like I said, the studies are small, but the divergence is there. Low sugar diets also lower insulin and insulin-like growth factor. That growth factor may be influential on cancer cells. There's lots of other potential mechanisms for benefit of dietary change in cancer, but primarily what we think we're doing with that is altering the internal environment. And, of course, the cancer has come to exist in a particular ecology, you know, a particular food sources, a particular pH. And to the extent that you can alter the food source, alter the pH, you potentially throw a monkey wrench in the work of the cancer physiology. So I would say, interesting. I can't really tell you whether I agree that it works, because I haven't gone and done that due diligence and tried to find the source literature that would support it. But that's how you go about validating a claim like this. You know, it isn't good enough that a whole bunch of people online say it works. You know, it's just, it's nice, but, you know, do you know, for example, the patent for this product, I do see that, and I'll just say it, the patent for this product is held by a family, and this product has gone through multiple names. It goes back 30 years. It's not new. And how do you know that this woman that wrote this book doesn't actually receive payment from this company to make sure that this is included in her book? You don't know that. I mean, I'm not trying to, you know, malign the author, but I'm just saying that, you know, who is this person? Is she an academic? Is she, what are the other books she's written? Does she do any research? Is she a cancer expert? Is she a popular author that's also written about weight loss, which would tend to, you know, change the amount of weight that I would put on her opinion and also the credibility of her statements. You see what I'm saying?
Okay. Well, I appreciate your input on that. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. I'm sure that people who are listening will go and investigate this now, and there may be someone who will really be benefited. Who knows? Maybe this is an actual thing. I keep my mind open on such matters. I have to. But I do look for the evidence before I'll, you know, tell people I think it's something they should do.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Dawn.
Thank you. Have a great day. Bye-bye. Bruce in Elkhorn sent me a very interesting question. Interesting research published in the New England Journal of Medicine. The efficacy of the HZSU vaccine, 97% in patients older than 50 years, compared with 51% in the Live-Zoster vaccine. So this is about the shingles vaccine. And the current shingles vaccine that is available is the Live-Zoster vaccine. So, Bruce, that's probably the one you had. This new vaccine is a Glaxo product, and the idea is that they're not using live virus, they're using the glycoprotein E, which is, in other words, one of those barcodes on the surface of the varicella virus, and that they're teaching the immune system to recognize this barcode because they're coupling this protein signal, glycoprotein E subunit, with a special adjuvant. And adjuvants, this one is ASO1B, but adjuvants are compounds that are irritants to the immune system. So they act like a red flag. They act, you imagine the immune system is has smoke alarms, and this smells like smoke to the immune system. So it revs up and starts looking for something to attack. And the interesting thing about the vaccine controversy is that as people really look at what's going on here with these adverse reactions to vaccines, do they really upregulate inflammation? Do they really, what's going on here? Is it really the specific protein that we're using, or is it the adjuvant? And a lot of thinkers are now looking at the adjuvants, particularly aluminum, and wondering if the adverse reactions that we see, the people who seem to have autoimmune conditions turned on, who develop more of a chronic fatigue picture after a vaccination reaction, are these individuals uniquely vulnerable to these adjuvants? And is there a threshold amount of adjuvant that is too much, such that when we take young children and we give them multiple vaccines all at once, are we crossing this mysterious threshold in some of these children? Now, it's always an emotional issue, but I think this concept of adjuvants does need to be understood. And the idea that you could take that glycoprotein and use a different adjuvant, possibly get a vaccine that was more dangerous, possibly get a vaccine that was less effective, like what we're seeing right now with the current pertussis vaccine, and the fact that the immunity that it creates is so short-lived that, you know, we effectively may actually not be helping the situation to vaccinate our population. Now, as a corollary to this, researchers are really looking at the immune system, and there's some fascinating basic research here about how the immune system works. So we've talked about this foreign protein. In the case of varicella zoster, it's the glycoprotein E subunit. So that's a cell marker that's found, well, it's not a cell marker, it's a viral marker in this case, but it's a protein with a sugar molecule that the immune system can recognize. And when we give a vaccination, when we're trying to irritate the immune system and wave this protein at it and say, here, fetch, you know, make antibodies against that. And what happens is that there are antigen-presenting cells, little special cells that hold the antibody out and wave it in front of the B cells and say, you know, make something that will attach to this. And the antigen is actually in the lymph node and in the spleen. And there are these areas that form called germinal centers. And so these little tiny structures that form in the immune system have B cells that are not yet committed to what they're going to be making. And the B cells they mutate rapidly. They divide. Each time they divide, they create a little bit different antibody. They put it on their surface. And the antigen that's being presented, if it sticks to the antibody on the surface of the B cell, then that B cell gets a stimulation to divide. And then more antigen, and so more B cells have more subtly different patterns, and the one that grabs the antigen the tightest is the winner. T cells actually send a signal to that B cell saying, go back in deep into the germinal center and divide and grow fast and make lots of you. And then those come out and they've mutated a little bit, and the strongest one goes back to the germinal center and is stimulated to divide until finally you've honed this process almost like evolution. you know, the bigger claw, the exact right beak on the Galapagos Island to dig insects out of that particular tree bark. So you've got the antibody that has evolved in the lymph cell, in the lymph node, excuse me, to be the best one. And then that's the one that gets turned into a plasma cell, a memory cell, and it circulates in your body potentially for the rest of your life. And that's how natural immunity works. And when we try to mimic natural immunity with our vaccines, we don't get it right most of the time. And so we need to revaccinate after 10 or 15 or 30 years because the immunity wanes, those memory cells wane. But in the case of natural immunity, the waning happens more slowly. Depends on the bug. In some cases, like pertussis, if you get whooping cough as a child, you'll be immune for maybe 10, 12 years, and then you'll be vulnerable again. But of course, you'll be an adult, so all you will get is the cough from hell. You won't die. And so it's getting through infancy and not getting pertussis that's really key for that particular illness. In any event, the idea that there's an evolutionary process going on inside your lymph nodes is fascinating. And another interesting thing about the germinal centers is that that's where most lymphomas occur. So the overstimulated, rapidly dividing B cells, well, one of them gets the wrong mutation, mutates into a cancer, and now you have a cancer clone. So that's where that connection between cancer and stem cells that we're always alert to kind of comes out. So our next email is from Peggy in Elkhorn. And basically what Peggy writes is, any update on the March 15, 2014 Regenex stem cell segment? On that segment, you discussed this procedure, which at the time was offshore. I've been using Synovisc shots every 6 months since March 2011 for damaged knee meniscus, wanting to postpone knee replacement. And I've been not getting worse, but I don't do a lot of physical activity. And my primary care physician who injects the shots told me that in August 2013, there may be hope coming. His brother is an ex-NFL football player and has been in a pilot group for the same stem cell process out of a facility in the Denver area. And so I checked that out. You gave me a link to this, and we actually found a place called Regenex in the United States, and they are, it's the Premier Stem Cell Institute.com. And they have a lot of good references in their article here. I was quite impressed with an article by Kayong Sa that was quoted. This is what I like to see in a website. So if you folks are wondering why I'm fussy and with the previous caller, what I'm talking about, this website has not just testimonials, they have article after article of double-blind studies, really serious, good science backing up their claims that they can replace cartilage. And honestly, my friends, I am really very, very impressed with this. The article, which I will post, because I think we should just put it up and let people look at it. So check for the resources, check in the resources section, which I know it's messy and I need to get it neatened up. The Journal of Arthroscopy and Related Surgery, Volume 27, Number 4, 2011. And this article, the particular thing I like about it is it has gorgeous before and after pictures of people's knees. They did very good science. They effectively, what they do is they go in, they sand down the cartilage, they drill holes into the bone, and they drill a hole. It's about a 2 millimeter diameter hole, and they drill them every 2 millimeters apart. So they just drill a whole bunch of holes down into the soft bone, the cortical bone, subchondral bone, excuse me. So it's the spongy bone, and that's where the bone marrow is. And that's where the stem cells are. Then after they do that, they actually inject a mixture of Synvisc, which Peggy was using in her knee, hyaluronic acid, and stem cells that they have harvested from the blood. So they give the people colony stimulating factor, which is supposed to make more white blood cells, and then it also stimulates the bone marrow kind of across the board, and so you get some circulating bone stem cells. And we can pick those out by their cell surface markers, the tissue antigens that they have on their surface. So you can actually essentially strain the blood and pull out the right stem cells, in this case cartilage stem cells, mesenchymal stem cells, and that gets mixed in with the hyaluronic acid and injected every, I believe they were doing this weekly, into the people who are in the study. And they do it for several months. They're doing all kinds of other things. They've got the bone in a, they've got the knee in a machine that straightens and extends it while you sit or lie down for 2 or 3 hours a day to stimulate the cartilage physically. But the pictures that they are showing at 2 years post-op of the same area of the bone shows nice, smooth, pretty new cartilage, not the lumpy stuff that we were talking about 2 years ago, but they seem to have actually perfected the technique. So take-home lesson here, I think it's ready for prime time. I'm impressed with the science of the articles, and I am impressed with the pictures. I'm impressed with x-rays that are showing new cartilage formation and the regeneration of the joint space. Yeah, it takes a couple of years, but these are impressive studies with very good science behind it. So I am going to give a big thumbs up to this concept that these private outfits that are doing cartilage regeneration are actually doing it. Now, what's it going to cost? Not covered by insurance. It's going to cost a lot, but it's only a matter of time before this replaces joint replacement. And so those of you who are getting by, like Peggy, keep on keeping on, because I am very impressed and persuaded that we are on the cusp of a major change in terms of the way we manage joints. And we may not be replacing knees that much longer, at least in these marginal situations where there's still enough cartilage left to get this going on. I think once you've got bone on bone and the hypertrophic changes which occur in the knee, it may be too late for this type of therapy, but it's extremely exciting. And thank you for asking me to revisit it, Peggy. And for those of you who are interested in looking at those pretty pictures, as I said, this is an article you can get the whole thing online. So I will post a link to where you can get the PDF and you can look at it. It's really quite impressive. Let's go now to Carol in Santa Cruz. Hello, Carol. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I have a question. I was talking to a friend yesterday who's taking biotin to increase the thickness of her hair, and I was wondering about what do you think of that and what amounts would be reasonable.
Okay. Well, biotin is a B vitamin that purports, you know, it's supposed to help with keratin formation in hair, and fingernails are made of keratin, a special type of protein similar but not identical to collagen. So doses that I would recommend, high doses. I usually tell people, first of all, you want to be taking a B complex because you need the other Bs on board. And you're going to, whenever you megadose one B vitamin and don't give other B vitamin support to the other ones, you're taking a risk, because there is at least a dozen potential methylation mutations that people can carry. And some of these interfere with your ability to push B vitamins through the system. So if you overload on one B vitamin and you have one of these mutations, you can actually get yourself in trouble. So I do recommend a B100 plus get the biotin up to about 5 to 10 milligrams, not micrograms, wow. Milligrams. Big, big dose. But at those doses, first of all, there's no known adverse effect, and you know the scientific community jumps on adverse effect of vitamins like fleas on a dog. So, I'm really happy to say that there's not a lot of literature, if any, on adverse effects of this, and there's definitely plenty of anecdotal, and I have personal clinical responses that patients have had in my practice. So I feel like it really works for some people anyway, and it's worth a try.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Let's take an email from Tom in Missouri. How to practice personal preventative medicine. How do you decide what preventative medicine to practice? For example, I'm 60 with no health problems and good lab numbers. Should I take fish oil, magnesium, etc.? Is my prostate sneaking up on me, just waiting to attack? Should I take saw palmetto, etc.? How do you decide what supplements, if any, to take? Waiting for symptoms isn't prevention, is it? Well, no, Tom, waiting for symptoms isn't prevention. That's the old horse has left the barn kind of situation. What to do? This is always a question. You feel good, you're 60, you're healthy, you look at ahead, you're looking ahead to 80, 85, going, icebergs on the horizon. How am I going to avoid that? And the first thing to do is regular exercise. You know, 30 minutes a day minimum, walking, bicycling, moderate exercise. That's just kind of like breathing and a regular BM. That should just flossing. That's just part of your body maintenance. The second thing is assessing the diet. You know, we talked about trace amounts of carcinogens in Coca-Cola. Good, healthy diet, lots of fruits and vegetables, maybe some extra green tea. These things all just reduce your cancer risk, and that's a good thing. I generally look over new patients who come in saying, you know, I want to maintain my wellness. I'll take a family history and look to see what icebergs that generates. If, for example, your father or your uncle had prostate problems, I might do a prostate exam and see if your prostate's large for your age or small for your age. If you've got a teeny tiny prostate, I probably wouldn't start saw palmetto. But if it were generous and you had no symptoms and a family history, I probably would. Maybe 500-600 milligrams a day just for prevention. And again, you know, a stitch in time saves nine and all of that. For nutrition, I like to get a fatty acid index, look at the omega-3s to the omega-6 ratio. We know what a healthy ratio is. And that's a simple blood spot test, probably cost you $50-$60, worth doing. Depending on the diet history, I might do organic acid testing. And this is urine testing for metabolic intermediates that shouldn't be there if you have adequate levels of vitamins. So it's a, you know, indirect way of saying, for this person with this diet, do they need more of anything because they have inadequate throughput due to genetic differences or issues with absorption? Because ultimately, you can put it in your mouth, but we don't know if it gets into your bloodstream. And even then, we don't know if it gets from there into your cells. And the devil, my friend, is definitely in the details. So that's my sort of recipe for maintenance of wellness. In general, after 60, I recommend that people assess their B12 and homocysteine annually. I recommend that you do get just a omega-3 index and also take a look at what your lipids are doing. And if you've got really high small particle cholesterol, then you may be one of those people who would benefit and reduce their risk of heart disease by going on either red yeast rice or a statin. There are people who need that. What we are moving to right now politically in medicine is a sort of minimum standard protocol. Everybody gets A, B, C, and D. And if they don't get A, B, C, and D, you're a bad doctor and we're gonna take back some money. And, you know, we're moving into that. Okay, it's a necessary evolutionary step. What I'd like to see us at in 10 to 20 years is that we take that low-hanging fruit off the genome, and we know that this individual needs not A, B, C, and D. Maybe they need A and B and E and G because they're different, and those are their vulnerabilities. And so the standard of care becomes treating to the vulnerabilities of the individual, not treating to this one-size-fits-all template, But, you know, we first got to walk before we can run. And right now, we aren't even treating everybody. We aren't even getting to a large percentage of the population. We have some serious work to do on healthcare access in this country. Obamacare was a very first tottering baby step, but we have a lot more to do before we can really do 21st century medicine. Maybe by the 22nd century, we'll be doing 21st century medicine. What do you want to bet? Let's go to Leslie in Ben Lomond. Hello, Leslie. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
I am a 66-year-old woman who is very active. I hike and walk, and I go to the gym. And I've been having some fairly minor knee issues over the last 6 months. They tend to flare up and flare down. I did go to an orthopedist and had a workup, and he said I have slight arthritis in my knee. And I don't really like taking medication too much, and I don't do well with ibuprofen. So he prescribed something called Milaxifen that I've been taking, he said, once a day as needed. I'm trying to take it as little as possible. But I do notice after a long hike or a long walk, often my knee will be aching later or painful. And I was talking to a friend the other night who has some arthritis, and she said something to me about marijuana dispensary ointment, which sounded really intriguing. And I was just wondering if you have any information about the ointment that might be dispensed and the efficacy of that.
First of all, let me comment on, you said Milaxifen. That, how would you spell that? Because that doesn't sound right.
Okay, I'm not home right now.
All right.
I don't have it with me.
But it's a prescription. Is it a prescription?
Yes.
Okay. I think it's Mobic.
It is Mobic.
Got it. Okay. All right.
Generic.
Yeah. All right. That's fine then. You pronounced it in an odd way, so I wasn't quite certain. So that's a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. Very standard conventional medical advice would be to take it after the activity. If you take it before the activity, you can do that, but you run the risk of masking pain that you should be listening to. If you do the activity and you start to hurt, then you need to self-limit. If you hurt later, that's where taking the Mobic Milaxifen after the event makes sense. And for a lot of sports people, when they're in recovery, the smart move is to have them exercise without any pain, any anti-inflammatories on board, and then take the anti-inflammatory as soon as they finish practice to reduce the post-activity swelling, which is what you're probably experiencing. Mm. Now, CBD, which is the cannabidiol compound that doesn't get you high, that's found in marijuana, and is, you know, turning out to be, we're so puritanical, you know, we don't want people to get high, but also, you know, it impairs you cognitively and affects your memory. So there's some legitimate reasons why you wouldn't necessarily want to take something that got you high every day. And so having a compound that doesn't have the central nervous system intoxication effects, but that does have anti-inflammatory effects, which CBD clearly does, is a legitimate way to go. And I have seen it work for neuropathy and other things that I don't really have good drugs for. So I'm, you know, very interested in seeing how this plays out. In terms of using it for your knee pain, it would be a legitimate thing to consider trying. You would probably, in order to purchase it, you'd probably need to get a medical marijuana card. Not super hard to get in California, but nevertheless, I would urge you to go within the law in this respect.
Yes.
You know, work within the system. There is a pathway through the system that is a safe path, and you have an indication that would be a legitimate indication. So, you know, I wouldn't do it under the table.
No, that was something I was thinking about doing, but I didn't want to actually pay the money for the card if somebody was going to say, well, this is not something that really does anything for you. And I don't When I was younger, I did smoke marijuana, and I don't like the high from it. So that was another part of it that was appealing to me, that psychotropic or whatever part of it is not in there.
Let me give you an alternative to the Mobic, though. I really don't like I really dislike non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, because the more I understand about the gut and the importance of maintaining a good gut-blood barrier, the less I want to erode that barrier with non-steroidal anti-inflammatories.
I would really like to have an alternative, because I don't like taking this.
Yeah. So let me give you an alternative that won't interfere with, that won't hurt your gut. And that's two things, and it's kind of a 1-2 punch. The first one is curcumin, which is a component of turmeric, a spice.
Yes, I do think that.
Right. And so you take like 500 to 700 milligrams of curcumin, not turmeric. You need grams and grams of turmeric to get anywhere near their curcumin. But about 5 to 750 of the curcumin daily will downregulate NF-kappa-B, which is the signal in your cells that turns on the whole COX cascade, the cyclooxygenase cascade that we block with ibuprofen and Mobic. So you're going upstream, and you're doing it in a way that does not interfere with normal body functioning. It just prevents the inflammatory cascade. So it's a very safe and healthy way to limit it. And the second way to limit it is to increase the amount of omega-3s in your system, because the omega-3 fatty acids are the backbone of these chemicals, the prostaglandins that are the inflammatory chemicals. And if you make the prostaglandin out of an omega-6 oil, which is like your safflower oil, then it's stronger as an inflammatory compound than if you make it out of an omega-3 oil. So first of all, you're making less of it because of the curcumin, and then secondarily, what you do make is less inflammatory. And so you really get a nice balance with those two. And I would say that is preventative at the level that you want, because you're getting knee pain from hiking. And we just talked earlier about cartilage and knee, growing new cartilage with this stem cell and drilling procedure. But ideally, we don't ever want you to need that kind of intervention. So it's like keeping your tires properly inflated and rotated, that you don't push the knee cartilage.
So the curcumin, and I have taken that in the past. I don't have it now, but I will get more. And I know to buy that at a really reliable place, because I have read this.
Right. You want something that's
doesn't really have it.
Yeah, but liposomal is good.
Pardon me?
I said liposomal is good.
Okay.
I like to, if you want to buy just turmeric powder and mix in about 10% black pepper, you need a couple of grams, maybe 3 or 4 grams of the powder a day. So you're looking at 8 capsules to get there. But if you do that yourself, it's way cheaper. So that's just something to put out there.
That's a good idea. Yeah, because that curcumin, I know it's not inexpensive.
Well, it's I sell some products at my office that are really highly absorbable, and it works out to about $1 a day to get the dosing. And for some people, that's a lot of money. And for others, it's not. And so if $1 a day is a lot of money, then you probably got enough time to sit there and watch a movie and, turn your fingers yellow.
So I'm clear on the curcumin, but now I'm not clear. You said to get omega-6 fatty acids?
Omega-3, that's the fish oils. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Omega-3. I wrote 3 in this.
Yeah, you want the omega-3s. We get plenty of omega-6 in industrial food, because it's typically made with cottonseed oil and safflower oil and other omega-6 oils. The reason that we didn't evolve with omega-6 oils available in the environment, because the seeds and the things that they're getting the omega-6 oils out of don't really yield that oil if you eat them. You have to squeeze them in a hydraulic press and expel the oil. And that's an industrial process that was invented, probably in the late 1900s. And so this is a new food source that we producing out of what was previously kind of waste. It's great that we could, you know, get the calories out, but we've shifted our diet a lot in the direction of these omega-6s, and because they make a more inflammatory prostaglandin, and that wasn't what we were supposed to be making. We were supposed to be making the omega-3 prostaglandins, but then these omega-6 oils came along, and it's just a coincidence that they're pro-inflammatory, but there you go. The story of the American food supply is just an absolute illustration of the law of unintended consequences.
Oh, I know, and I really try to not do processed much of anything.
Yeah, good. Well, it sounds like you're on the right path. So get back to us and let us know how that works out for you.
I will, and I think you'd have to give a little bit of time for that to start to be effective.
About 2-3 weeks.
Not an overnight. Yeah. But, okay. Well, great. Thank you so much for that information. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. So we're going to go to another email. This is from Tim in Nebraska. Just a quick one. Dr. Don mentioned a prebiotic fiber. I was wondering what it was. It was inulin. Inulin is bacteria chow for the good guys. And inulin is found in high levels in Jerusalem artichoke, kiwi fruit, and jicama. And I, not regular artichokes, the Jerusalem artichokes, those grow underground. They're tasty. Or you can buy inulin powder, which is cheap and well-tolerated. Start out with a quarter teaspoon and work your way up to a full to 1 to 2 teaspoons a day. And that is an adequate dose to keep those probiotic bacteria growing. And we're learning now that you can't just take probiotics because we can't grow all of the ones you need. But if you eat the food, the ones you need will spontaneously thrive. And that's going to happen as soon as 2 to 3 days after you make the change. But like I said, work if you're going to take concentrated fiber like inulin, you want to work up gradually from a quarter teaspoon a day to 2 teaspoons a day over several weeks, or you will be the gas bomb. And you don't want to go there. Going now to Ron in Carmel. Hello, Ron. Welcome to the program.
Oh, hi, Dr. Don.
Hi.
I've got a question. I think I've asked you a little bit about this several months ago. I've been now about 7 months into acid suppression therapy for Barrett's. And I was told recently about taking a DGL as a possible something that could maybe help with the healing on the scarring.
Yep.
And I would just want to get your feedback on that and see if there's...
Yeah, I think it's a really, really good idea. DGL is one of a class of agents called demulcents in traditional herbology. And demulcents, coat your throat, and they also coat your esophagus. So slippery elm is another one. Aloe vera is another one. Marshmallow, not the white candy thing that you toast over but there's actually a plant called marshmallow.
And I haven't seen that in a lozenge, but I guess it's...
Well, you know, you don't need a lozenge. If you take it in a capsule, it still works. And so the idea here is that these compounds help coat the area in question, and they protect the mucus. And so I think they're very helpful for healing. Another thing that when you're trying to heal mucosa, upper GI tract mucosa, is glutamine. L-glutamine is an amino acid. You can buy it in powder form, maybe a teaspoon of that a day, because that's just bricks and mortar. And if you're trying to rebuild skin and rebuild mucosa, that can be very helpful. It's also really nice for your small intestine. The proton pump inhibitors interfere with your absorption of B12 and your absorption of calcium. So over the long run, although with Barrett's, you may need to stay on these. I always tell my Barrett's patients who are on long-term proton pump inhibitors, get a monthly shot of B12 and make sure that you take a liquid form of calcium. So you can get calcium citrate powders, you can get various other forms, but you want it to be in a liquid when you when you take it, because then it's already dissociated. And that means that you don't need acid to absorb it, and you are taking away your acid. And there's good literature, 10 years of a proton pump inhibitor just about doubles your risk of osteopenia.
Yeah, I'm kind of concerned about that.
And you should be.
So taking something like Bone Up with the vitamin K, that's really not going to do it.
Well, the problem is that under most circumstances, under ordinary gut circumstances, it would be fine. But because you lack the acid to cause the calcium to break down, you need the calcium in a pre-broken down form. So you can find liquid calcium or powders that you just mix into liquid and drink. And that's really the best way to ensure that you're going to get the calcium into your system.
Okay, and how about timing on that?
You want to take no more than 500 milligrams of calcium at a time, so you probably take it twice a day. You want to be sure that you take it with some vitamin K, which is in the Bone Up. And the reason for that is you don't really want the calcium going to your arteries. You want it going to your bones.
And then the timing on those other things would be?
They could be just, you know, along the vitamin K doesn't matter. So which other things specifically were you?
In other words, getting back to taking the DGL and those things that are coating.
Yeah, you know, I don't actually find that it matters too much whether you take them with or without food. So I'll often have people take them at bedtime, and again in the morning, just because that's convenient.
Oh, I was thinking it was like the other, like the actual Prilosec, where you have to time it.
No, you don't have to time this with the food.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I keep forgetting.
Yeah. Well, the whole reason that they have you time the proton pump inhibitor with food, it's catch 22. To activate the proton pump inhibitor, you need acid. So if you don't have any acid, then you can't activate the proton pump inhibitor. And that's one of the reasons for treatment.
Can you take it after the meal? I mean, is that a big deal? Or does it always have to be before?
Best before, but if you forget, by all means, take it after. There'll still be some acid in your stomach.
Well, great. Thank you so much for all these additional helpful hints. I'll definitely go shopping and add them to the regimen.
All right. Very good. Bye-bye. Just a quick shout out to Elise and Big Sur and all of the friends of Barclay Henry. Elise wrote asking about what she might do about all of the polyps that were just found at her second colonoscopy. She showed up with a bunch of tubular adenomas, which are precancerous. She was told by a doctor there's an unusually low occurrence in people who eat an African diet. That's because the African diet is very, very high fiber, and we've known for many years that a high fiber diet helps prevent polyps, probably related to the species of bacteria that thrive in a high fiber environment, actually. There has been some work looking at use of daily ibuprofen or aspirin in reducing the number of polyps. Curcumin, because it acts on the same mechanism as ibuprofen and aspirin, would likely work as well. So I would say curcumin at the doses we've already discussed in this program and a really high fiber diet with lots of whole grains, wheat, oat bran, inulin, beans, and basically get yourself having two big poops a day, horse poops, I call them. And you really want to practically clog the jaw. And that's a high fiber diet. That's what an African person's diet, that person eating an African diet, that's what their poop looks like. That's the low risk poop. So if you're trying to change the polyp trend, you're going to need to change your poop, change your probiotics inside. And I'd also kick my vitamin D level up to about 50 using supplements. So one last quick call, and this to Gil in Santa Cruz. Hello, Gil.
Hello.
Hello, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I am a professional musician, a guitarist. I have arthritis in my left thumb. I've recently taken two shots of cortisone given by a surgeon in the last month. I've been on Mobic for 5 years. And I try to take a lot of Omega. I'm just looking for alternative therapies that may give me some relief. I can't stop practicing or playing because that's how I make my living.
Have you gotten an X-ray? Do we know how much actual bony pathology you've got?
Yes.
Is there something?
The cartilage is paper thin. It's almost bone on bone. It's really advanced.
It's really advanced. Okay. So you do realize that it's only a matter of time before this aspect of your income does go away. I mean, you're it's like the bald tire situation. So at some point, you will need to be playing a different instrument. And as a musician, there's other possibilities. I would, you know, suggest you work on things that are less thumb intensive and see what you can come up with. You've got a little bit of lead time here. I would consider the use of the topical ointments, either the medical marijuana ones we talked about earlier on the show, or you could use topical anti-inflammatory. There's a ketoprofen ointment that you can get. There's a Voltaren ointment. One of them is a prescription. The ketoprofen is compounded at Loudon's, the local compounding pharmacy. And I've had good luck with both of those, and as far as that goes, the CBD for the hand, because the hand is so darn thin in terms of the, it's just skin. You know, there's not a lot of fat. You can easily get into the joint. And also hot pepper ointment, which just reduces the pain signal. It burns like crazy for the first week, and capsaicin cream, basically. And then after the first week, you've kind of burnt out the pain receptor, the pain producing cells that produce something called substance P, and it doesn't hurt anymore. Now, you're still injuring it, but you're not having pain. And so, you know, it covers it up. But hey, you know, at this point, you need something to cover it up so you can keep working. I'm afraid we're out of time, but I hope that little quick bit of advice has been helpful for you.
Thanks. We'll talk again sometime.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And indeed, we've come to the end of another hour. Boy, that went fast. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did, and I'll be back next week with more answers to your emails and your calls and more interesting science in the news. We didn't get even through all the cool stuff I had for you, but hey, next Saturday, right? See you there. So long, stay healthy.